Hello and welcome to this week's podcast in our ongoing series, Home is Where the Hearth Is, from my home in South Carolina here, by the open window, looking out on the beautiful sunny day. I can hear my son playing on the swing outside, and my daughter, who's until recently, was cleaning out the chicken and duck pen. So today's topic in the series within the series, because currently we're discussing for the next several weeks and the past several weeks for that matter, what every Catholic should know about literature. And we've covered the pagan era so far, Homer, Sophocles, Virgil. And now we're going to reach the Christian era, and we're actually going to spend today in Anglo-Saxon England, one of my favourite places, and in the presence of Beowulf, one of my favourite works of literature. Now, Beowulf was written, most experts agree, including my favourite expert on Beowulf, J.R.R. Tolkien, who actually, in case we don't know, was his day job, was as a philologist at Oxford University, and he was one of the world authorities on Old English, on Anglo-Saxon English, and on Beowulf in particular. Not only did he translate the whole poem from Old English into Modern English, but he also wrote a critical essay called The Monster and the Critics about Beowulf, which is basically held as one of the seminal critiques of the poem. Now, Tolkien, amongst other people, sees the Beowulf poet, who's anonymous. We don't actually know who he is, although he was almost certainly a Christian, and almost certainly, for that matter, a monk, that he was a contemporary of Saint Bede the Venerable, the great Anglo-Saxon historian who wrote the ecclesiastical history of England. Now, that's intriguing because it means that we've got some historical context for when Beowulf was written, because Beowulf was basically a contemporary of Bede, and Bede's a historian, so he's given us some sort of context for what England was like at the time that Beowulf was written. So, for instance, many critics are in denial about Beowulf being a Christian poem. The general consensus in the secular world is it's basically a pagan poem with a sort of just a little bit of a not very important Christian sort of niceties, but that really essentially it's a pagan poem, and notwithstanding the fact that it was penned by a monk, the fact is that the work itself is quite clearly Christian, and that's what I should be talking about, over not just Christian of course but Catholic. There was only one form of Christianity. Well, that's not true, there were heresies, which we're talking about in a moment. But there was certainly no Protestantism as we know it at that time, and the schism between East and West did not happen at that time. So this was Catholic England, a Catholic monk, a Catholic writer who also happens to be a Catholic monk, and this is a Catholic work. So that's what I'm going to hopefully elucidate over the next 10-15 minutes. Those of you that have read Beowulf will know that it's basically divided into three sections, shall we say, in which Beowulf, the hero of the poem, fights three different monsters. So the first monster he fights is Grendel, and the second is Grendel's mother, and the final one is the dragon. And although there are three different monsters, in another sense, in a thematic sense, we can actually divide the poem into two. The first part of the poem is the fight with both Grendel and Grendel's mother, and the second part is the fight with the dragon. And thematically they do vary, including in the method of the allegorical dimension. So the first part of the poem, we are told that Beowulf is the greatest warrior alive, he's the strongest. He can swim further and faster. He can fight harder. He's the greatest warrior. He's the strongest man. He has everything. He's the Superman, shall we say. Nearest thing we can get amongst mortals to being a god. Now, what's the purpose of this? Well, the author is setting up, okay, what about if we are as strong as we can possibly be? What will that mean in the fight against evil, the fight against monsters? Well, Beowulf, using his physical strength, just his pure muscles, defeats Grendel and rips off Grendel's arm. So, you know, this is showing that this man is so strong, he can even defeat these hideous monsters that are basically killing everybody. But then, when he faces Grendel's mother, and there's a symbolic diving into a pool, and he's down there, symbolic of death, and when he, of course, emerges triumphant, resurrection, and also, by extension, baptism. But the key thing is that he is going to lose this second fight against Grendel's mother. Even the strongest man alive cannot defeat the power of evil using purely his own strength. And it's only because of the appearance of a magical, or probably more correctly, a miraculous sword at the key moment. Beowulf's own sword, his own human sword, symbolic of his own human strength, cannot defeat Grendel's mother, cannot defeat the power of evil. However strong he is, and whatever man-made tools and weapons he might have, he cannot defeat evil. He needs this supernatural assistance, this miraculous sword that appears. And this sword, unlike his own sword, has the power to defeat and destroy the monster, Grendel's mother. Now, what's the significance of that? Well, again, if we read St. Bede, his ecclesiastical history, we know that England, especially of the whole of Christendom, England at that time was beset by a heresy called Pelagianism. And Pelagianism as a heresy was that a man can get to heaven merely through the triumph of his own will. All you have to do basically is listen to the words of Jesus, do what Jesus would do, and if your own will could allow you to just do what Jesus tells us to do in the gospel, you will go to heaven. In other words, it's about your will alone. Now, what does this mean in practical terms? Well, it means we don't need grace. We just do it ourselves. We just listen to what Christ teaches and do it. So we don't get any supernatural assistance, which theologians call grace. Which means that we don't need the sacraments. It means that we don't need the church. So clearly what the Beowulf poet is doing in this poem is showing us that, on the contrary, it doesn't matter if we're the strongest, most noble, most virtuous person in the world, we cannot defeat satanic power. And by the way, Grendel, right at the beginning of the poem, is likened to original sin, to the seed of Cain. She's taken right back, and he's angered by the song of creation that's being sung in the mead hall. In other words, glorying in God's creation. He's angry about that. So he's likened to the devil. That we cannot defeat supernatural evil without supernatural assistance. That's basically what the poem, the first part of the poem, the struggle with Grendel and then Grendel's mother, shows us. Our own strength is not sufficient. All right, so that's the first profoundly Christian dimension of the poem. And let's go to the final part, which takes a different approach, when Beowulf, as an old man, fights the dragon. And this time, the Beowulf poet uses a very different allegorical technique. Whereas in the first, the allegory is subsumed within the action of the plot. In the second, it's actually conveyed via numerical signifiers. Now, let me explain what I mean by that. Well, I'll just tell you what happens in the story and you'll get it. So we hear that Beowulf, amongst all of his followers, he's the king after all, Beowulf, amongst all of his followers, handpicks 12 special followers, an inner sanctum, if you like, apostles or disciples. So we see initially, if our allegorical antennae should be twitching, okay, the king chooses, handpicks 12 followers. Maybe there's something going on here that's going to be analogous to the gospel. to Christ. And of course, that is exactly what happens, because we are told that one of the 12 raises the wrath of the dragon through an act of theft. Very similar, by the way, to what happens in The Hobbit. Tolkien, obviously influenced by Beowulf. And so the dragon's wrath is raised because of this original sin, if you like, by the 12th member, who is in that sense both a Judas and an original sinning Adam figure. And Beowulf says he must face the dragon alone. So he's not going to raise an army against him. No one can defeat the dragon except Beowulf alone. And the 11 remaining companions, in fact the 12th one goes as well, but he's press-ganged, he's forced to go. They go to face the dragon, but when the dragon's about to appear, all but one of the apostles of his 12 handpicked followers run off into the safety of the woods, leaving just one loyal disciple to be with him as he faces the dragon, as he faces the devil and dies. Now the final scene of the poem. We have a burial mound in memory of Beowulf, raised on a headland so that ships can see it and not crash on the rocks. So it's something that's going to keep people safe. And around that burial mound, 12 knights are riding in a circle. So there's all sorts of things happening here. First of all, there's 12 again. So the evil disciple has been replaced, exactly as it happens, of course, in Scripture. But the fact that the 12, of course, the imagery, by the way, of knights, it's not just medieval, it's actually church militant. The church here is the church at war. We are, Milus Christi, soldiers of Christ, and we are fighting the power of the devil, who's the prince of this world. So an understanding of the church militant, which is all too seldom stressed, although the teaching of the church hasn't changed on it. We are the church militant. The church in heaven is the church triumphant. The church in purgatory is the church suffering. So we are the church militant. So this image of the 12 apostles being 12 knights, and they're riding in a circle, which signifies eternity, something unbroken, that this, what Beowulf has established with his 12 followers, is something which will last and endure as a guide to people in the perilous and treacherous seas, oceans of life. So we see again in the poem Beowulf, a profoundly Catholic poem with a profound teaching about the dangers of heresy such as Pelagianism, and using through these numerical signifiers the story itself to draw analogies with the gospel. Well, thanks so much for joining me on this latest Home is Where the Hearth Is podcast, in which currently we are going through what every Catholic should know about literature. Today has been Beowulf. And next week, we will come to the great Dante. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Goodbye and God bless.